Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. What do we do now?
That's a good question.
Let's see. The Personal Wealth Coach, yes. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a riveting, meaning painful and holds you in place and won't let you go anywhere, radio presentation. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that offers investment advice and management to people with a lot of money to invest and be advised on and manage.
That's a rough way of saying it, but yeah, I agree
and
with that.
And nothing that we say on here should be construed to be investment advice or make any sense whatsoever, because we make no attribution to that effect.
Yes, we're not attempting to make sense.
And
just dollars.
Right. Well, I don't know. We're not even making dollars on this. I mean, we'd love to make some dollars. But from our understanding of the economic system, that is the exclusive domain of banks.
Making money.
Right. They make money. The rest of us just kind of move it around from one place to another.
We gather money.
Yeah.
Other folks, you know.
But we invest money.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we do. And the telephone number in here, if you would like to join with us on this Saturday, March 18th, and you ask us any questions about the economy or investing or anything of that nature, but nothing whatsoever about commercial or team sports.
They can ask. We're just going to have really absurd answers.
Right. Then give us a telephone call at 254-773-1400, and you can stimulate our otherwise somnolent brains into doing something reasonable.
Yes.
So, what do we do now?
Well, we got... typically, we talk about what's happened in the last week. Most people have a calendar, so they realize that the week started on Sunday, unless it's a business-oriented week, and it's a Monday. But when we're talking about what happened in the week, we're talking about what happened with the markets. So mm-hmm. Would you like to start with that in your traditional way?
Okay, traditionally, the market was on Wall Street, and it pretty much stayed where it was. But other than that, there was a little bit of movement in the numbers, not much, nothing to get too excited about. As a matter of fact, it's something to get pretty much unexcited about.
The headline yesterday, I think you said it, and I laughed about it. NASDAQ today was flat.
Yeah, I said that verbally. Yeah, the NASDAQ was flat today.
Well, I mean,
actually, it was flat.
Tire repair.
We had a flat NASDAQ. Actually, the Standard & Poor's 500 index. 500 stock index, Standard & Poor's version, went up 0.24% this week. Isn't that exciting?
That's not flat. See, there's a 0.24% there. I mean...
Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, on the other hand, really got exciting, and it went up 0.06%. 0.06% for the week.
Wow.
Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, it's incredibly so. I mean, my heart rate just jumped up by a very tiny amount.
So that's what happened during the week. Anything else?
Let's see. What else happened this week?
Gold didn't go anywhere. It pretty much stayed. If you have enough gold, actually, the only thing it's doing is just kind of spinning around with the planet, because it's really hard to move.
Well, and just on that note, I would expect the gold prices to drop a bit in the next couple of weeks. You can quote me on that if you'd like.
Why would you expect them to drop a bit?
Russia and Venezuela. There. Now it sounds like I know things. Venezuela is down to
it's actually
about...
Venezuela. There's a U in the middle.
Well, Germany is actually pronounced...
Deutschland.
Deutschland. So I get to butcher the names of foreign countries because we do it as a policy on many of them. So
right.
It's fine.
Good. Okay.
Okay. So Venezuela...
That's because there's a zoo in the middle of it.
There's a zoo in the middle of it, yeah. Yes. They're down to about their last $14 billion of foreign reserves. Most mm-hmm. of that foreign reserve is held in gold. And last year at this time, to meet budgetary requirements and to pay debts to foreign countries, They sent about $10 billion of gold to Switzerland.
Don't forget to pay their president.
Right.
Okay.
So they sent the gold last year at about this time. It's about time for them to do it again, and they may just sell it all because there's not a whole lot left compared to what they once had.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia is depleting its piggy bank as well. It's reserve that it's had for rainy days and so on that it built up when the price of oil was around $100 a barrel. And one of the things that they did to avoid having to buy American dollars is they bought gold,
mm-hmm.
which is a problem in that when a lot of foreign countries that don't like the United States very much buy gold, when they sell that gold on the market because they want money for that gold so that they can spend it on whatever their programs are.
Their president's salary.
Yes. The price of gold drops, which makes it so that the reserves that they thought they had, they don't have as much of, particularly when two countries are doing it at the same time. So I would expect that over the next month or so, you to see a downward blip in the movement of gold. And this is a great example of why we don't use gold as a currency. Because if you think you have a certain amount of reserves, but people don't buy billions of dollars of gold on a normal basis.
What?
There's a thinly traded market for gold. And that means it's more volatile. That means, you know, when you're talking about gold, most people in the United States, or the world for that matter, don't take a portion of their paycheck and put it away into gold. That's the vast majority of people do not do that.
Right.
Some people do.
There's probably some truth there.
The jewelers, the people that make jewelry, they do. They need to buy gold. There are some people that are on payment plans to gold purchasing places. But what that says is that as a percentage of the overall supply of money out there, gold is a small one, and it doesn't move around very much. It's heavy. And trying to sell it, this is what Venezuela discovered last time around, is the shipment cost to get it to Switzerland was pretty expensive. It was millions of dollars to get that thing, to get that moved from one place to another. That's a large commission before you even have the commission for the sale. So anyway, that's you mentioned gold and a moment ago, and I thought I'd throw in the little pieces that are factoring around that. A lot of the countries, you know, Saudi Arabia has most of its reserves in dollars, but they bought some gold. And they're unhappy with the fact that they bought the gold, because when they bought the gold to take up some of that surplus that they made from all that oil money, gold prices were really high too.
Mm-hmm.
So now they doubled down on two commodities. That's probably not the best thing in the world. Russia is probably going to run out of its rainy day fund sometime in the middle of 2017.
Hmm. It'll be interesting to see what they do from that point.
Right. They're last year, just for funsies, I suppose, they tapped another reserve that they have that's not meant to meet budget shortfalls. It's the pension reserve. And there are a lot of pensioners in Russia. The population in Russia is an aging population, and there's a lot of elderly people there. So when you tap the pension reserves, it means people don't get their pensions, or they get big delays in the pensions. So consider if Congress started tapping the Social Security fund.
Wait a minute.
They do. Wait a minute. Meaning they tapped the money that was being paid to you and just suddenly said, no, this month you get half of what you expected. And that's what's happened in Russia. It happened once last year, and it's likely to start happening quite a bit in the future as the rainy day fund disappears, which is going to cause some instability and some unpopularness to Putin, which he has traditionally responded with invasions.
Well, back to the United States stock market. The S&P 500 may not have moved up much, but putting it in a little perspective, it's still up about 30% from February 11th of last year, which is not at all a bad deal. If you'd managed to get in at the into an S&P 500 index fund or something, which we certainly don't recommend, at this point, around middle of February, when everybody wanted to flee because the world was coming to an end and the market was going to crash and it was headed down, it was almost at a correction point, but it never quite made it there, then you'd be up about 30% right now. The year to date, the S&P 500 is up 6.23. Better yet, it's up 16% from 1 year ago. It's up almost 30% from where it was, or a little over 30% from where it was in mid-February. So the stock market has done, as a market of things you could have bought into, has done exceptionally well over the last year. About half of that run-up has come since the presidential election, and the market continues to cruise along based on hope. However, there's some good news about that.
Good news about the hope, or good news?
Well, there's good news in that if the market does what it's doing right now, which is basically just runs flat, which, barring a surprise, is probably where it's going to be for a while. I think it's about as inflated as it's likely to get based on promises, because the promises out of out of Congress and the White House are looking less and less likely to be fulfilled in the manner that people initially thought. But what's happening underneath, what's happening in the regular economy, is really good. We have a lot of indicators in the regular economy that we have some consistent, steady growth going on. And yeah, because of that, the market's run up, if it doesn't keep on running up, if it stays pretty much where it is for a while, the economy will catch up with the market and we won't need to have any of the promises fulfilled.
And it'll still be fairly priced in the market.
It actually is not unfairly priced right now. But I think a lot of the psychology in the market is such, and it is a little bit concerning to us, that it's about 15%, maybe 20% run-up in the market based on hope. Hope of a corporate tax cut, hope of
regulatory reform, individual tax cuts, deregulation across the board.
But, by the way, none of that run-up, and this is a crucial item, none of that run-up was based on repeal of Obamacare.
Correct.
And Congress and the president seem to be pretty focused on repealing Obamacare, and that would cost corporations a whole lot of money, so that would be the reverse of what the run-up in the market is about. So even if the House bill, what did you call it, the American
Health Care Act,
the American Health Care Act were to pass, you'd probably see a dip in the market simply because it passed.
Well, by the way, just as a side note, I have read it. Just like I read the Affordable Care Act, I did that thing in my on very limited spare time, but it was easier to read than the Affordable Care Act.
Really,
because it made lots of references to language in the Affordable Care Act. So, I just read this bill, and it makes lots of references to paragraph numbers in the Affordable Care Act, and I didn't follow those references. I just kept reading because I read the Affordable Care Act like 7 years ago when it was passed, and I don't have a clear memory of everything that I read. This is something that is, I think, very important. I got an email on this subject this week,
really?
With a request for me to talk about it, about how do you work this system to make it work better. Let's take a step back and say, there's problems. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an Independent. When insurance rates go up at 20% a year, there's a problem. And before we had the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if you will, it doesn't matter what you call it, it's this law. It requires people to get insurance or they get a tax against them, a fee, a mandate says you've got to do it. Before the Affordable Care Act, insurance rates were going up at about 20 to 22% a year. After the Affordable Care Act was passed and went into practice, that dropped down to about a 2 or 3% increase for a couple of years. And then it jumped back up in the last 2 years to double digit and then 20% or so rate increases again. So it's like the Affordable Care Act hadn't been passed, except that the middle ground, we saved some money. How did that happen? Well, the easy things that came into place at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act, which the Republicans by and large dislike in the campaign season, but seem to be the things that they want to keep in the new act, which are keeping the kids between the ages of 18 and 26 able to be covered under their parents' insurance, that kept the rates down. Those were the sweet things that came with the, I mean, it's like if you have a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down, that was the spoonful of sugar. You keep that really, really, really healthy population that doesn't get sick very often in there, and you give them a pretty good assurance of that healthcare being paid for because it's being paid for by their parents, then that keeps the rates down. Well, now those easy solutions are out of the mix, and let's take two steps back and say that we're looking at the wrong part of the problem. The focus was lasered down into the insurance area, because that's how most people pay for their medical coverage. What we didn't do is look at insurance as a generality. Instead, we were looking at health insurance. There's a real problem here, and there's already a solution. So let me say what was happening before Obamacare. Before the Affordable Care Act, we had socialized medicine. People say, what? No, we didn't. It was a capitalized system. Obamacare came in and made it socialized. If we refuse to turn people away at the emergency room, if you've got a not-for-profit hospital, which is the vast majority of hospitals, there are laws that say that you cannot turn people away if they show up at the emergency room. I don't think even, well, there are probably some hardcore people that would say spurting chest wounds leave you don't have insurance, but the vast majority of us look at that and say, we got to get treatment for this person. It doesn't matter what the cost is. This person's about to die. Let's get them fixed. We'll worry about the bills later. So we've made laws to that effect. If you're not for profit hospital, you got to accept the people that come in the emergency room. Okay. Here's where this is still socialized, because if they couldn't pay, the hospital had to charge more to everybody else. That's redistribution of wealth. That's socialism. The Affordable Care Act just did it in the insurance side. It was already happening indirectly in the insurance, in that the hospitals would raise the cost to other people, and the insurance rates would go up because they had to meet those costs. So we had a socialized system that was replaced by a formalized socialized system. Wasn't completely socialized. There's an exchange. There's a for-profit group of organizations that are competing for your for the revenue
for
stream.
Your premium dollars,
right?
As opposed to your non-premium dollars.
But there were ratcheted down extreme regulations on how they could charge and how much they could charge, and just following those rules added more expense on the insurance side, because they had to figure out where it was that they needed to charge appropriately. And if they charged more than 20% of the premium went to overhead at the insurance rather than directly to medical costs, any dollar above that much was a penalty on the insurance company that had to go back to the insurance holders. That's a problem. And that if they have a cost overrun and you in essence double the cost overrun as a penalty, that doesn't make the insurance company want to stay in the market. This is why the big insurance companies left. So there are some major problems there. let me get right down to the root of the issue that's being ignored by Congress. And I said there's already a solution out there. There's something called the Blue Skies Act, or the Blue Sky Acts. There were a lot of acts, more than 50. Each state passed a law for the sale of securities, stocks and bonds, that was essentially the same law as every other state. If you think of it in the terms of like a concealed handgun permit, when you have reciprocity where the other states look at your permit and say, yes, you're allowed to carry a gun, they do the same thing for securities. If it's a stock or a bond, we have the same laws in Minnesota, in Maine, and in Texas. So if you're selling a stock and you say this stock is worth something that it's not and you charge for it, then it's the same law that's broken, even though it's got a slightly different name. It's got a state's name associated with it. If we did the same thing for insurance, then this concept that Congress keeps talking about and presidential candidates, doesn't matter if it's Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump, or Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon, shopping across state lines. Here's the problem with shopping across state lines. Wow, there's a Klingon vessel approaching. Did you hear that?
Yes, that was actually me.
Shopping across state lines, you start getting into the realm that is federal rather than state regulated. And the states wish to regulate insurance in their state, and they do not allow insurance from another state to be sold in their state.
And there's a very good reason for that.
There's a lot of very good reasons for that. What were you going to put in?
Each state has a premium tax.
That is correct.
And it's
I was getting to that. Yeah.
Okay, good. So the point is that a big source of revenue, for example, for the state of Texas, is they have a premium tax, which is like a sales tax on insurance premiums. And if you were to buy, let's say, an insurance policy by sending your money to Louisiana,
they don't get the tax. Louisiana gets it.
Texas doesn't get the tax. Louisiana does. Therefore, each state is very, very protective in not allowing you to buy insurance from some other state.
Right. And Congress can't change that because the Constitution clearly, well, they could change it with a constitutional amendment, but the Constitution clearly says they're only allowed to regulate interstate trade, trade that passes borders of states. If the states don't allow trade insurance to cross borders, then Congress can't regulate it and say you're allowed to shop across state lines. They just simply cannot do it. It's one of the great expenses for insurance companies. If you're a huge insurance company like United or Blue Cross Blue Shield or any number of the
other big ones.
Well, let's say you are for a moment.
Let's make
your face look like a corporate logo for a moment. Okay, so you're trying to offer an insurance policy. Somebody in your corporation comes up with this great idea. Here's the best new insurance policy. Yes, and this probably actually happens. People get excited about the new policy and new coverages and so on. Depending on where that person is based, they might be in New York, they might be in Florida, they might be in Louisiana, Minnesota, doesn't matter. Some state, they're based there. Their idea is based in that state's insurance law. And if that policy, that new policy, the new type of policy being listed by this national company, they say, let's use that as a model for all the states. Let's say we'll use that as a model. Well, they have to, in every state, have a fairly large legal team, a fairly large group of actuaries get together and make the changes to that policy to fit that new state's laws, which means that the policy at the end, the two policies, don't look anything alike anymore. They were designed by the same people for the same reason, but they're completely different. And the overhead cost to the insurance company of having a legal team and a group of actuaries in every state just trying to figure out what laws for insurance get passed in each state in a way that they can keep up with is a huge expense. if they could, if we really could shop across state lines, and we had a universal practice of regulation of insurance, that would make a lot of sense. Now, what is the big hurdle there? It's a lot bigger than passing Obamacare or the American Health Care Act. And that is, you would either have to get every legislature and governor to agree on a law, which we've done. We did that with the Blue Sky laws.
But the issue is that states do not levy a tax on the sale of securities.
They did. Before they did. The Blue Sky laws, they did. Hmm. So you have to get the states to give up revenue. In essence, give that revenue to the federal government instead of the state.
So you're suggesting that the legislature of Texas should give up some of its revenue and send it to the federal government.
And that's not going to happen.
Right.
But this is the solution. If we start talking to governors, if at the, I don't want to say the grassroots level because that's so silly and overblown, but instead if we looked at the state level and we said, all right, what states already have similar laws?
Yeah, but it's not going to happen.
No, it's not, which is one of the problems that Congress is going to run into again and again. It's one of the problems that every president is going to run into. They're
right.
going to run smack into the wall of federal power is limited, and as long as you have laws that are in Florida and in Louisiana, by the way, it's not regulated at the state level. In Florida, it's at the county level. In Louisiana, it's the parish level.
Actually, there is a solution, and most of our listeners will hate it when I mention it.
What's that?
There is a strong...
TRICARE?
No. Well, sort of.
The federal government can do it on their own.
But now this
Medicare
is
and TRICARE are both...
But I'm just saying, we have a constitutional pass on Medicare, and the federal government, in essence, has established a tax, and it pays for health care.
Yep.
And it's a uniform system, and you get to pick your doctor.
That's the single-payer system that many in the extreme left really like. The Canadians are doing it.
Well, I don't like the Canadian plan, but I do like the English and the German plan.
I'm not a big fan of the German plan. I mean, they get good quality health care, but the way they do it is a huge section of the budget.
I'm simply saying that it works. And the point is, by the way, folks, we are the only developed nation on the planet that does not have a uniform health care system. And very notably, a uniform, centralized, single-payer health care system. And very notably, we spend, depending on which set of statistics you read, about 30 to 50% more per citizen on health care in the United States than they do in any other developed country in the world, any other country in the world. But it gets a little better because if you survey, and there have been a lot of them in the United States, what you find is our satisfaction with our health care system is the lowest of any developed country, but we pay 30% to 50% more for our health care. There's something wrong with that picture. And I realize that we fundamentally are against a single-payer, I mean, as a nation, we're against a single-payer system unless you're over 65, and then we're very much for
I better
a
get
single
it
payer
because
system.
I paid into this my whole life.
And frankly, with all its warts and pimples, it would dramatically reduce the cost of it would reduce the budget deficit. There's a host of things it would do.
This is an issue here, and it sounds like we're endorsing true socialism here. We're not. We're talking about what are possible solutions. Other countries are doing some things.
All we're saying is Social Security and Medicare are socialized systems.
Yes.
They are in place. A lot of our listeners are under them. It was an interesting survey I read, by the way, about the health care acts. The Affordable Care Act. An absolute majority, a very significant majority, like 58% of Americans approve of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
But only about 38% approve of Obamacare.
Right.
They're exactly the same thing. They're just two names for the same thing.
No, they're not. They're not the same thing.
They're not?
No. If they were the same thing, they'd get the same approval rate.
No, they don't. Because the point is, Obamacare is the informal name
given
to the Affordable Care Act.
There have been a whole series of late-night talk shows that have gone out and asked, man-on-the-street style, do you prefer the Obamacare over the Affordable Care Act? And they would say, well, no, I think the Affordable Care Act is a much better.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's political references here, and people generally don't read the silliness. And I do, and you do, and that's...
But you see, therein is the problem. When you've got something that's something approaching 60% of Americans like, and Congress is trying to repeal it, and it goes away. According to the Congressional Budget Office, something like 14 million people will lose their health insurance under the American Care Act.
Yeah, but some people will gain insurance over it. It looks like there's a total... Well, these are estimates, and the Congressional Budget Office really missed the number of insured people under the Affordable Care Act, too.
So maybe it's 11 million people.
Let's say this clearly. The Congressional Budget Office is pretty good at estimating revenue from taxes. It's pretty good at estimating drop in revenue from taxes, and it seems to be pretty abysmal at guessing behavior of the American people when there's like a disincentive, like the penalty. They don't know how – they missed that. They said there were going to be 20 million people enrolled by this point above what was before, and there have been like 14 million.
Mm-hmm.
And – so looking at the amount of error, I wouldn't go on that part of the CBO report. I wouldn't say how many people are going to be insured is any kind of accuracy. The revenue to the government and the rate increase were pretty spot on. They're good at that kind of thing. And they're saying that 2018, if the American Healthcare Act was passed this year, and went into effect next year, which that's the only way you can do it. There's already insurance in place for this year. You would have to cancel everybody's insurance and have them rewritten, and that would be a mess. So it would go into place next year, and they're predicting a raise in premiums of 20%. Here's the thing. There's a prediction of a raise in premiums of 18.9% under the current law. However, if the new law gets passed and we get essentially the same raise in premiums, now instead of blaming the Democrats, we blame the Republicans. This is the sticky wicket. We want to stay away from it. This is, you know, the old school tar baby of doing this. The Republicans are about to get a lot of egg on their face. The Democrats are about to be able to point at the Republicans in the same way that the Republicans have been pointing at the Democrats. And that just says that unless we get together as a group, all Americans, and recognize the problem and say, how do we do this together to get it to work right, we're going to be doing this the next time Democrats control all, you know, the Senate, the White House, and the House. We're going to see another one where they're going to say, let's repeal the American Health Care Act. So unless we can break this polarity and get together and pass something together, we're going to see this again. Maybe 2 years, it may be 4 years, it may be 6 years, but it's not going to be palatable if there are no Democrat votes in the Senate for this law, just like it wasn't palatable for having no Republican votes in the Senate for the Affordable Care Act. And there's my spiel. There are solutions, but it requires an impossibility, and what that is for us to all hold hands together and sing Kumbaya, and I really don't see that happening anytime soon. We've done it in the past, but I don't think we have the incentive to do it right now. And we've got commercials to play. Is that why you were pointing at the clock? Okay. Well, if you would like to give us a call at the Personal Wealth Coach here, you can reach us locally, 254-773-1400, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm going to play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here remain 773-1400. Of course, the area code is 254-773-1400, the telephone number. There used to be numbers. We used to have a fancy phone with lots of, but it's still here. It just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, it's sitting over in the corner. It is working very well gathering dust.
Yeah, that's it. It does a very good job of that.
I love, they have labels on the equipment in here, and one-fifth of the labels say broken.
Well, I think...
Top-of-the-line equipment in here.
I think it's a political issue.
It's a broken system?
The system is one-fifth broken. Right.
We got to shake it up. Don't shake the system!
So there was actually a lot of economic news this week, and the market did nothing with each release of economic news, which in and of itself tells you something about what's going on. Basically, the market has already priced in a lot of optimism. So when good news comes along, and that's about all we got this week was good news economically, the market did nothing because it was already up there. But oddly enough, it jumped up just a bit and then pulled back at the announcement by the Federal Reserve that they raised the rates from, well, technically when we say the rates were at 0.5%, they were actually 0.5 to 0.75. It's a quarter point spread, but the way it's commonly reported is the lower number. So they raised the rate from 0.5 to 0.75, and they continued with their outlook of doing three rate increases this year, this being the first one. So it means that the next one will take it, the interbank rate, to 1%, and the one after that will take it to 1.25%, and that'll be it for the year. The reason there was no, at least the reported reason, that there was no big move in the market at this point was because they'd already said they were going to do all this stuff, and they're just doing what they said they were going to do. The real news was when Janet Yellen said, "We have confidence in the robustness of the economy and its resilience to shocks." That's
big news from the Federal Reserve.
That's certainly not what we've heard before. What we've heard a year ago, for example, when the market was down something approaching 20% because of fall in oil prices. And by the way, there's indications we may see some more fall in oil prices this year. Was that one little shock could push us over the edge. And that's where we thought we were a year ago. And a lot of people thought we were a year ago. It's also worth remembering at this point with the Dow Jones Industrial Average around 21,000. It's kind of bobbed around 21,000. That back in 2009 and 2010, and I realize this is ancient history to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's like 7 and 8 years ago.
There were, when the Federal Reserve stepped in and flooded money into the economy, and the amount of dollars they pushed into the economy. They did this, by the way, by buying bonds and that converts them to dollars. So they put dollars in the banks to replace worthless bonds. And the talk show hosts, particularly on Fox, at least that's where I saw them.
Big ones were Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, all called that this was going to lead to runaway inflation.
Hyperinflation was forecast and a collapse of the dollar, and you should buy gold.
They're not economists, though. They're political commentators.
But if you'll notice, had you bought gold, you'd be really unhappy. Had you bought into the stock market, you'd have been really happy. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. It's Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Discussion on the Affordable Care Act and all that. Look, Jake made an absolutely perfect statement a moment ago.
No. Don't say that to him. His head is already too big.
I don't want to jinx him, but okay. I said, look, if this thing passes as it is without a single Democrat vote and it doesn't work, which it won't because it's not a very good bill, but then the Republicans own the problem. But I wanted to point out that I think is kind of fake news that I see coming out of the media, and I don't know if you guys have thought about it in this way, but
are we reporting fake news?
No. Let me get to the point here. I think that the CBO should probably be abolished. It doesn't do a very good job most of the time.
Mm.
But when I believe the number, guys, was 24 million people will, quote, according to what I've read in the paper, lose their insurance under the Republican plan. But think about it. What does the Republican plan abolish that the Democrat plan has?
The individual mandate.
The individual mandate. And so when you're not paying a huge penalty or you feel like you're being forced onto a plan, young people who are healthy at this point are going to drop off. And that's where that $24 million is likely to come from, or a large part of it.
Actually, there's a lot more to it, and they said initially it would be 14, but they actually gave a whole series of reasons, some of which make pretty good sense. There's a lot of employers right now who have health insurance that didn't have health insurance before, because the Affordable Care Act demanded that if you have more than 50 employees, you have to have health insurance. And
it wound up putting some business out of business.
But a lot of surveys have indicated that those companies that didn't have health insurance before would just drop the health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you then had health insurance premiums running where they are now or a little higher, an awful lot of those employees wouldn't have health insurance.
Yeah, but look at what this bill doesn't really address. Jake's read it. I haven't read it. But does it really address how to stop the rapid rise in the inflation of health care?
No.
Guys are talking about inflation. No,
no,
we haven't had bad inflation. We've had it in two major places, though, and one is health care. The other is college tuition.
Right,
yeah. There's one
places where the government pumps in
There's a solution there. It's an easy solution. It's not
really
one that most people will do. We need to start eating the elderly.
Yeah, well, that could be, but
the
look,
reality is that we have a generation, multiple generations, that are getting older and living a lot longer than we expected, and the medicine that's being invented to help them
gets more and more expensive.
Gets more and more
expensive
and extends their lives.
But let me throw out a couple of things. Look, I created an entire health plan one time that I think is a lot better than this one. It would take forever to go through the whole thing, but I believe there's three kinds of insurance that perhaps we could look at, or three kinds of health care. One is day-to-day. You just go get your annual physical, you got a sore throat, you go to the doctor, it's no big deal. The American people should pay for that out of pocket. And then there's the second tier, which is more serious. You have to have surgery, something like that. And then there's the third one, which is catastrophic. And we try to treat all these things as if they're the same, and they are not. If we go to my idea and split this up into three things, the American people then become more involved in paying for their own health care. They're likely to ask a doctor, what is this going to cost
they go in? You just described Medicare.
Well, not exactly.
Because you basically pay out of pocket at the low end, and then when it starts to get expensive, if you've got part, you're not required to have Part B. If you have Part A Medicare, then it just pays the catastrophic hospital bill.
And you're right back at the same thing. But how do we get the general public interested at all in holding the cost of health care down if they go in, they get treated, they never know what it costs, somebody else pays it?
Well, there's an area here that Donald Trump really hit well, and that is that Medicare can't negotiate for prescription drugs.
That's right. It was forbidden to do so, by the way, by the Republicans.
Right. That doesn't work. We got to fix that, because that's the 600-pound gorilla, maybe even the 6,000-pound gorilla of the healthcare world is Medicare. And if the pharmaceuticals base all of their prices for every insurance company, their beginning opening negotiation is, this is what Medicare pays us. Why should we take less from you? It's like having the gorilla negotiate for the pharmaceutical companies with the insurance companies, and that doesn't work.
True. I gotta go here in just a second. But why? The thing that just bothers me more than anything else about this is that I don't see where the federal government has the right to even be involved in this sort of a thing. And if we went, we have 50 states. Democrats think we have 57, but I counted 50. And if we went to the states, just as Massachusetts had their Romney Care, and Washington State, I believe, did something, or Oregon did, along these lines, we could have 50 experiments on what works, and then the states could pick and choose what they think works, and keep this closer to home and more local. It doesn't make any sense for me to the federal government to be involved, because all we're going to do is have Democrat versus Republican wars, and nothing will ever get done, and the cost keeps going up the more government pumps money into it.
You know, you mentioned something, Lynn, that's exactly right, that requires an overhaul of the system. I went to a physician and got a physical because I've been sick in the past, and the physician looked at my blood work and said, well, you need this test and this test and this test, and he's right. Mm-hmm. I needed those tests, and this is just a regular physical that you're talking about out of pocket. The bill that I got was $2,556.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that going in?
No. but I knew it coming out. Now, this is the most interesting thing to me, the fact that I have a health care program. Now, I'm paying out of pocket until we get some pretty high deductibles out of the way, thousands of dollars. But I got a 50% discount on that bill because I had health insurance. Now, there's something fundamentally wrong with the fact that if a person walks into a doctor's office, they're charged $2,556 for a series of tests and seeing the doctor. Whereas if I walk in there because I have health insurance but I'm still paying out of pocket, I get a 50% discount. There's something wrong with the picture.
Right. That should be illegal, and no less than 60 Minutes did a full investigative story on that a few years ago, but obviously it didn't change anything.
There's another piece here, and this is one that we haven't touched on except very, very lightly, and that is that the not-for-profit hospitals out there, they have to follow some pretty strict rules to be not-for-profit, but if you're a hospital, it generally is better to be not-for-profit. You can get federal money. There's a lot of other stuff that can come to you. Once we go to a system where the people giving the care don't look at the price, and the people receiving the care don't look at the price.
That's where we are now.
We get cost craziness. And and that's really the issue, is that we've got another piece here. There is a shining example of goodness in the middle of the American Health Care Act. And that is...
Guys, I got to run, but I enjoy the show. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks
all right. Thanks for the call.
All right. Try not to run in the street.
Yes. And that that is the limitation of liability to doctors. They basically are doing what Texas did and capping punitive damages on doctors and saying that if there is damages, you could get the damages back, but the punitive damages get capped. And one of the things that happened in Texas when the punitive damages for doctors was capped at $200,000 per incident is it lowered the healthcare rates in Texas. The rates of insurance dropped here where it didn't happen elsewhere in the country. Now, that was a one-time event. It's now been priced into the system. But that's another one of those areas where insurance reform has to start at the state level. And if each state attempts this, the danger with that is that what happened with RomneyCare is that the first 2 years it worked wonderfully until the surrounding citizens of the states around it found out that they could go and get really nice care just by crossing the border and getting an apartment somewhere and saying, hey, I live here now. Well, and that caused the rates to skyrocket.
And the backside to it is, for example, Texas, he was talking about let the states do it. Texas, there's no way that Texas could get revenue from its existing sources to accommodate a healthcare system.
No, but if we used the same, this is a piece here. I haven't seen any of the taxes for the Affordable Care Act being canceled by the new American Health Care Act.
The surcharge for Medicare, isn't that canceled? That's canceled in the new
Act. But that's not considered a tax. So the capital gains increase, the other pieces of, you know, if you make more than $250,000.
Those are all canceled, I think.
I didn't see it in there.
You didn't see it in there? No. Well, I was reported that they canceled all those taxes, and that would cause that's the backside to this, is it would cause that alone would cause a pretty significant increase in the deficit, which means they need to cut Medicaid payments dramatically,
which is in the law,
but they wait a few years to do it.
Right, they cap it out at 5 years and then stop.
But the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, is revenue positive for the government.
Yeah, it is.
So canceling the Affordable Care Act with its taxes on upper-income people equates to increasing the deficit.
This is a sticky wicket.
Yes, it is.
This is, you know, when Trump was campaigning and I said this is a lot more complicated than he thinks it is, a couple of weeks ago he said, who knew healthcare would be so complicated? Well, people that had looked at it, it's pretty complicated stuff. There's not the easy solution is there isn't an easy one. There's no easy way out of this.
There's an easy solution. It's just politically unacceptable.
Well, there's a series of easy solutions, starting with eat the elderly all the way down to...
No. That's a violation of the law.
You can't eat the elderly? No. You think we would save all those hungry people, wouldn't be hungry anymore?
No, let's not even talk about
that. I'm being facetious, by the way. I don't endorse cannibalism, nor do I endorse abuse of the elderly.
But, you know, again... taking very frankly, in my opinion, if you took the European systems that people like that are less expensive than our system right now, and we looked at the positive aspects of those systems, we brought it home to the United States and modified it a little bit here and there to make it fit us, I think. I mean, it's like somebody else has experimented
right
with a healthcare system that covers everybody. By the way, our mortality rates in the United States, infant mortality rates all the way up through everything else, are higher than they are in many third world countries.
Yeah. And we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting all weekend long. You can reach it locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that line toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, listen to podcasts, read our philosophy and the newsletter. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.